Chapter 6. That was my night off. I sat in the living room of our little house, smoking cigarettes, listening to the radio, and watching the dark come up out of the ground to swallow the sky. Television is all right, I've nothing against it, but I don't like how it turns you away from the rest of the world and toward nothing but its own glassy self. In that one way, at least, radio was better. Janice came in, knelt beside the arm of my chair, and took my hand. For a little while, neither of us said anything, just stayed that way, listening to Kay Kaiser's College of Musical Knowledge and watching the stars come out. It was all right with me.
"I'm so sorry I called you a coward," she said. "I feel worse about that than anything I've ever said to you in our whole marriage."
"Even the time when we went camping and you called me Old Stinky Sam?" I asked. And then we laughed and had a kiss or two, and it was better again between us. She was so beautiful, my Janice, and I still dream of her. Old and tired of living as I am, I'll dream that she walks into my room in this lonely, forgotten place where the hallways all smell of piss and old boiled cabbage. I dream she's young and beautiful with her blue eyes and her fine high breasts that I couldn't hardly keep my hands off of, and she'll say, "Why, honey, I wasn't in that bus crash. You made a mistake, that's all." Even now I dream that. And sometimes when I wake up and know it was a dream, I cry. I, who hardly ever cried at all when I was young. "Does Al know?" she asked at last. "That John's innocent? I don't see how he can."
"Can he help? Does he have any influence with Cribus?"
"Not a bit, honey." She nodded as if she had expected this.
"Then don't tell him. If he can't help, for God's sake, don't tell him."
"No." She looked up at me with steady eyes.
"And you won't call in sick that night. None of you will. You can't."
"No, we can't. If we're there, we can at least make it quick for him. We can do that much. It won't be like Delacroix." For a moment, mercifully brief, I saw the black silk mask burning away from Del's face and revealing the cooked blobs of jelly which had been his eyes.
"There's no way out for you, is there?"
She took my hand, rubbed it down the soft velvet of her cheek.
"Poor Paul. Poor old guy."
I said nothing. Never before or after in my life did I feel so much like running from a thing, just taking Jan with me, the two of us with a single packed carpet bag between us, running to anywhere.
"My poor old guy," she repeated.
And then,
"Talk to him."
"Oh, John?"
"Yes. Talk to him. Find out what he wants."
I thought about it, then nodded. She was right. She usually was. Chapter 7. 2 days later, on the 18th, Bill Dodge, Hank Bitterman, and someone else, I don't remember who, some floater, took John Coffey over to D-Block for his shower. And we rehearsed his execution while he was gone. We didn't let Toot Toot stand in for John. All of us knew, even without talking about it, that it would have been an obscenity. I did it. "John Coffey," Brutal said in a not-quite-steady voice as I sat clamped into old Sparky. "You have been condemned to die in the electric chair. Sentence passed by a jury of your peers." John Coffey's peers? What a joke. So far as I knew, there was no one like him on the planet. Then I thought of what John had said while he stood looking at Sparky from the foot of the stairs leading down from my office.
"They're still in there.
I hear 'em screaming.
Get me out of it, I said hoarsely. Undo these clamps and let me up. They did it, but for a moment I felt frozen there, as if old Sparky did not want to let me go. As we walked back to the block, Brutal spoke to me in a low voice, so not even Dean and Harry, who were setting up the last of the chairs behind us, would overhear. I've done a few things in my life that I'm not proud of, but this is the first time I ever felt really actually in danger of hell. I looked at him to make sure he wasn't joking. I didn't think he was. What do you mean?
I mean we're fixing to kill a gift of God, he said. One that never did any harm to us or to anyone else. What am I going to say if I end up standing in front of God the Father Almighty and he asks me to explain why I did it? That it was my job? My job?
Chapter 8. When John got back from his shower and the floaters had left, I unlocked his cell, went in, and sat down on the bunk beside him. Brutal was on the desk. He looked up, saw me in there on my own, but said nothing. He just went back to whatever paperwork he was currently mangling, licking away at the tip of his pencil the whole time. John looked at me with his strange eyes, bloodshot, distant, on the verge of tears, and yet calm, too, as if crying was not such a bad way of life, not once he got used to it. He even smiled a little. He smelled of ivory soap, I remember, as clean and fresh as a baby after his evening bath.
"Hello, boss," he said,
and then reached out and took both of my hands in both of his. It was done with a perfect, unstudied naturalness. "Hello, John?" There was a little block in my throat, and I tried to swallow it away. "I guess you know that we're coming down to it now. Another couple of days." He said nothing, only sat there holding my hands in his. I think, looking back on it, that something had already begun to happen to me, but I was too fixed, mentally and emotionally, on doing my duty to notice. "Is there anything special you'd like that night for dinner, John? We can rustle you up most anything. Even bring you a beer if you want. Just have to put it in a coffee cup, that's all."
"Never got the taste," he said.
"Something special to eat, then?" His brow creased below that expanse of clean brown skull, then the line smoothed out and he smiled.
"Meatloaf'd be good."
"Meatloaf it is, with gravy and mashed." I felt a tingle, like you get in your arm when you've slept on it, except this one was all over my body. In my body.
"What else to go with it?" "Dunno, boss. Whatever you got, I guess. Okra, maybe, but I's not picky."
"All right," I said, and thought he would also have Mrs. Janice Edgecombe's peach cobbler for dessert. "Now, what about a preacher? Someone you could say a little prayer with night after next. It comforts a man. I've seen that many times. I could get in touch with Reverend Schuster. He's a man who came when Dell..."
"Don't want no preacher," John said. "You been good to me, boss. You can say a prayer if you want. That'd be all right. I could get knee-bound with you a bit, I guess."
"Me?" John, I couldn't. He pressed down on my hands a little, and that feeling got stronger.
"You could," he said. "Couldn't you, boss?"
"I suppose so," I heard myself say. My voice seemed to have developed an echo. "I suppose I could, if it came to that." The feeling was strong inside me by then, and it was like before when he'd cured my waterworks, but it was different, too. And not just because there was nothing wrong with me this time. It was different because this time he didn't know he was doing it. Suddenly I was terrified, almost choked with a need to get out of there. Lights were going on inside me where there had never been lights before, not just in my brain, all over my body.
"You and Mr. Howell and the other boss has been good to me," John Coffey said. "I know you've been worrying, but you ought to quit on it now. Because I want to go, boss."
I tried to speak and couldn't. He could, though.
What he said next was the longest I ever heard him speak.
"I'm rightly tired of the pain I hear and feel, boss. I'm tired of being on the road, lonely as a robin in the rain, not never having nobody to go on with or tell me where we's coming from or going to or why. I'm tired of people being ugly to each other. It feels like pieces of glass in my head. I'm tired of all the times I've wanted to help and couldn't. I'm tired of being in the dark. Mostly, it's the pain. There's too much. If I could end it, I would. But I can't."
"Stop it," I tried to say. "Stop it. Let go of my hands. I'm going to drown if you don't. Drown or explode."
"You won't explode," he said, smiling a little at the idea.
But he let go of my hands. I leaned forward, gasping. Between my knees, I could see every crack in the cement floor, every groove, every flash of mica. I looked up at the wall and saw names that had been written there in 1924, 1926, 1931. Those names had been washed away. The men who had written them had also been washed away, in a manner of speaking, but I guess you can never wash anything completely away, not from this dark glass of a world. And now I saw them again, a tangle of names overlying one another, and looking at them was like listening to the dead speak and sing and cry out for mercy. I felt my eyeballs pulsing in their sockets, heard my own heart, felt the windy whoosh of my blood rushing through all the boulevards of my body like letters being mailed to everywhere. I heard a train whistle in the distance, the 350 to Priceford, I imagine, but I couldn't be sure because I'd never heard it before. Not from Cold Mountain, I hadn't, because the closest it came to the state pen was 10 miles east. I couldn't have heard it from the pen, so you would have said, and so until November of 32 I would have believed, but I heard it that day. Somewhere a light bulb shattered, loud as a bomb.
"What did you do to me?" I whispered. "Oh, John, what did you do?"
"I'm sorry, boss," he said in his calm way. "I wasn't thinking. Ain't much, I reckon. You feel like regular soon."
I got up and went to the cell door. It felt like walking in a dream. When I got there, he said,
"You wonder why they didn't scream. That's the only thing you still wonder about, ain't it? Why those two little girls didn't scream while they were still there on the porch?"
I turned and looked at him. I could see every red snap in his eyes. I could see every pore on his face. And I could feel his hurt, the pain that he took in from other people like a sponge takes in water. I could see the darkness he had spoken of, too. It lay in all the spaces of the world as he saw it. And in that moment I felt both pity for him and great relief. Yes, it was a terrible thing we'd be doing. Nothing would ever change that. And yet we would be doing him a favor.
"I seen it when that bad fella he done grabbed me," John said. "That's when I knowed it was him done it. I seen him that day. I was in the trees, and I seen him drop them down and run away. But
you forgot," I said.
"That's right, boss. Until he touched me, I forgot."
"Why didn't they scream, John? He hurt them enough to make them bleed. Their parents were right upstairs, so why didn't they scream?"
John looked at me from his haunted eyes. "He say to the one, 'If you make noise, it's your sister I kill, not you.' He say that same to the other. You see?"
"Yes," I whispered. And I could see it. The Dederick porch in the dark. Wharton leaning over them like a ghoul. One of them had maybe started to cry out, so Wharton had hit her, and she had bled from the nose. That's where most of it had come from.
"He killed them with their love," John said. "Their love for each other. You see how it was?"
I nodded, incapable of speech.
He smiled. The tears were flowing again, but he smiled. "That's how it is every day," he said, "all over the world." Then he lay down and turned his face to the wall.
I stepped out onto the mile, locked his cell, and walked up to the duty desk. I still felt like a man in a dream. I realized I could hear Brutal's thoughts. A very faint whisper. How to spell some word. Receive, I think it was. He was thinking, I before E except after C. Is that how the dad ratted thing goes? Then he looked up, started to smile, and stopped when he got a good look at me. Paul, he asked, are you all right?
Yes.
Then I told him what John had told me. Not all of it, and certainly not about what his touch had done to me. I never told anyone that part, not even Janice. Elaine Connolly will be the first to know of it, if that is she wants to read these last pages after reading all the rest of them. But I repeated what John had said about wanting to go. That seemed to relieve Brutal, a bit, anyway, but I sensed, heard him wondering if I hadn't made it up just to set his mind at ease. Then I felt him deciding to believe it, simply because it would make things a little easier for him when the time came.
"Paul, is that infection of yours coming back?" he asked. "You look all flushed."
"No. I think I'm okay," I said. I wasn't, but I felt sure by then that John was right, and I was going to be. I could feel that tingle starting to subside.
"All the same, it might not hurt you to go on in your office there and lie down a bit."
Lying down was the last thing I felt like right then. The idea seemed so ridiculous that I almost laughed. What I felt like doing was maybe building myself a little house, then shingling it and plowing a garden in back and planting it, all before supper time.
"That's how it is," I thought, "every day, all over the world. That darkness, all over the world."
"I'm going to take a turn over to admin instead. Got a few things to check over there."
"If you say so."
I went to the door and opened it, then looked back.
"You've got it right," I said.
I before E, except after C. Most of the time, anyway. I guess there's exceptions to all the rules. I went out, not needing to look back at him to know he was staring with his mouth open. I kept moving for the rest of that shift, unable to sit down for more than 5 minutes at a stretch before jumping up again. I went over to admin, and then I tromped back and forth across the empty exercise yard until the guards in the towers must have thought I was crazy. But by the time my shift was over, I was starting to calm down again, and that rustle of thoughts in my head, like a stirring of leaves it was, had pretty much quieted down. Still, halfway home that morning, it came back, strong. I had to park my Ford by the side of the road, get out, and sprint nearly half a mile, head down, arms pumping, breath tearing in and out of my throat as warm as something that you've carried in your armpit. Then, at last, I began to feel really normal. I trotted halfway back to where the Ford was parked and walked the rest of the way, my breath steaming in the chilly air. When I got home, I told Janice that John Coffey had said he was ready, that he wanted to go. She nodded, looking relieved. Was she really? I couldn't say. 6 hours before, even three, I would have known, but by then I didn't. And that was good. John had kept saying that he was tired, and now I could understand why. It would have tired anyone out, what he had. Would have made anyone long for rest and for quiet. When Janice asked me why I looked so flushed and smelled so sweaty, I told her I had stopped the car on my way home and gone running for a while, running hard. I told her that much, as I may have said, there's too many pages here now for me to want to look back through and make sure lying wasn't much a part of our marriage. But I didn't tell her why. And she didn't ask. Chapter 9. There were no thunderstorms on the night it came John Coffey's turn to walk the Green Mile. It was seasonably cold for those parts at that time of year, in the 30s, I'd guess, and a million stars spilled across used-up, picked-out fields where frost glittered on fence posts and glowed like diamonds on the dry skeletons of July's corn. Brutus Howell was out front for this one. He would do the capping and tell Van Hay to roll when it was time. Bill Dodge was in with Van Hay. And at around 11:20 on the night of November 20th, Dean and Harry and I went down to our one occupied cell, where John Coffey sat on the end of his bunk with his hands clasped between his knees and a tiny dab of meatloaf gravy on the collar of his blue shirt. He looked out through the bars at us, a lot calmer than we felt, it seemed. My hands were cold and my temples were throbbing. It was one thing to know he was willing. It made it at least possible for us to do our job. But it was another to know we were going to electrocute him for someone else's crime. I had last seen Hal Moores around 7 that evening. He was in his office, buttoning up his overcoat. His face was pale, his hands shaking so badly that he was making quite some production of those buttons. I almost wanted to knock his fingers aside and do the coat up myself, like you would with a little kid. The irony was that Melinda had looked better when Jan and I went to see her the previous weekend than Hal had looked earlier on John Coffey's execution evening. "I won't be staying for this one," he had said. "Curtis will be there, and I know Coffey will be in good hands with you and Brutus." "Yes, sir, we'll do our best," I said. "Is there any word on Percy? Is he coming back around, is what I meant, of course. Is he even now sitting in a room somewhere and telling someone, some doctor most likely, about how we zipped him into the nut coat and threw him into the restraint room like any other problem child? Any other lagoon, in Percy's language? And if he is, are they believing him?" But according to Hal, Percy was just the same. Not talking, and not, so far as anyone could tell, in the world at all. He was still at Indianola, being evaluated, Hal had said, looking mystified at the phrase. But if there was no improvement, he would be moving along soon. "How's Coffey holding up?" Hal had asked then. He had finally managed to do up the last button of his coat. I nodded. "He'll be fine, Warden." He'd nodded back, then gone to the door, looking old and ill. How can so much good and so much evil live together in the same man? How could the man who cured my wife be the same man who killed those little girls? Do you understand that? I had told him I didn't. The ways of God were mysterious. There was good and evil in all of us. Ours not to reason why. Hotcha hotcha roadie do. Most of what I told him were things I'd learned in the Church of Praise Jesus the Lord is Mighty, Hal nodding the whole time and looking sort of exalted. He could afford to nod, couldn't he? Yes, and look exalted, too. There was a deep sadness on his face. He was shaken, all right, I never doubted it, but there were no tears this time, because he had a wife to go home to, his companion to go home to, and she was fine. Thanks to John Coffey, she was well and fine, and the man who had signed John's death warrant could leave and go to her. He didn't have to watch what came next. He would be able to sleep that night in his wife's warmth, while John Coffey lay on a slab in the basement of County Hospital, growing cool as the friendless, speechless hours moved toward dawn. And I hated Hal for those things. Just a little, and I'd get over it, but it was hate. All right. The genuine article. Now I stepped into the cell, followed by Dean and Harry, both of them pale and downcast. "Are you ready, John?" I asked. He nodded. "Yes, boss, guess so." "All right, then. I got a piece to say before we go out."
"You say what you need to, boss."
John Coffey? As an officer of the court, I said it right to the end. And when I'd finished, Harry Terwilliger stepped up beside me and held out his hand. John looked surprised for a moment, then smiled and shook it. Dean, looking paler than ever, offered his next.
"You deserve better than this, Johnny," he said hoarsely. "I'm sorry."
"I'll be all right," John said. "This the hard part. I'll be all right in a little while."
He got up, and the St. Christopher's medal Melly had given him swung free of his shirt. "John, I ought to have that," I said. "I can put it back on you after, if you want, but I should take it for now." It was silver, and if it was lying against his skin when Jack Van Hay switched on the juice, it might fuse itself into his skin. Even if it didn't do that, it was apt to electroplate, leaving a kind of charred photograph of itself on the skin of his chest. I had seen it before. I'd seen most everything during my years on the mile. More than was good for me, I knew that now. He slipped the chain over his head and put it in my hand. I put the medallion in my pocket and told him to step on out of the cell. There was no need to check his head and make sure the contact would be firm and the induction good. It was as smooth as the palm of my hand.
"You know, I fell asleep this afternoon and had a dream, boss," he said. "I dreamed about Dell's mouse."
"Did you, John?" I flanked him on the left. Harry took the right. Dean fell in behind, and then we were walking the Green Mile. For me, it was the last time I ever walked it with a prisoner.
"Yep," he said. "I dreamed he got down to that place Boss Howell talked about, that Mouseville place. I dreamed there was kids, and how they laughed at his tricks. My!"
He laughed himself at the thought of it, then grew serious again.
"I dreamed those two little blonde-headed girls were there. They's laughing, too. I put my arms around them, and there's no blood coming out their hair, and they's fine. We all watched Mr. Jingles roll that spool, and how we did laugh. Fit to bust, we was."
"Is that so?" I was thinking I couldn't go through with it. Just could not. There was no way. I was going to cry or scream, or maybe my heart would burst with sorrow, and that would be an end to it. We went into my office. John looked around for a moment or two, then dropped to his knees without having to be asked. Behind him, Harry was looking at me with haunted eyes. Dean was as white as paper. I got down on my knees with John and thought there was a funny turnaround brewing here. After all the prisoners I'd had to help up so they could finish the journey, this time I was the one who was apt to need a hand. That's the way it felt, anyway.
"What should we pray for, boss?" John asked.
"Strength," I said without even thinking. I closed my eyes and said, "Lord God of hosts, please help us finish what we've started, and please welcome this man, John Coffey, like the drink but not spelled the same, into heaven, and give him peace. Please help us to see him off the way he deserves, and let nothing go wrong. Amen." I opened my eyes and looked at Dean and Harry. Both of them looked a little better. Probably it was having a few moments to catch their breath. I doubt it was my praying. I started to get up, and John caught my arm. He gave me a look that was both timid and hopeful.
"I remember a prayer someone taught me when I was little," he said. "At least I think I do. Can I say it?"
"You go right on and do her," Dean said. "Lots of time yet, John."
John closed his eyes and frowned with concentration. I expected now I lay me down to sleep, or maybe a garbled version of the Lord's Prayer, but I got neither. I had never heard what he came out with before, and have never heard it again. Not that either the sentiments or expressions were particularly unusual. Holding his hands up in front of his closed eyes, John Coffey said,
"Baby Jesus, meek and mild, pray for me, an orphan child. Be my strength, be my friend. Be with me until the end. Amen."
He opened his eyes, started to get up, then looked at me closely.
I wiped my arm across my eyes. As I listened to him, I had been thinking about Dell. He had wanted to pray one more at the end, too. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Sorry, John. Don't be, he said. He squeezed my arm and smiled. And then, as I'd thought he might have to do, he helped me to my feet. Chapter 10. There weren't many witnesses, maybe 14 in all, half the number that had been in the storage room for the Delacroix execution. Homer Kribus was there, overflowing his chair, as per usual, but I didn't see Deputy McGee. Like Warden Moores, he had apparently decided to give this one a miss. Sitting in the front row was an elderly couple I didn't recognize at first, even though I had seen their pictures in a good many newspaper articles by that day in the third week of November. Then, as we neared the platform where old Sparky waited, the woman spat, "Die slow, you son of a bitch!" And I realized they were the Dettericks, Klaus and Marjorie. I hadn't recognized them because you don't often see elderly people who haven't yet climbed out of their 30s. John hunched his shoulders at the sound of the woman's voice and Sheriff Kribus's grunt of approval. Hank Bitterman, who had the guard post near the front of the meager group of spectators, never took his eyes off Klaus Dettericck. That was per my orders, but Dettericck never made a move in John's direction that night. Dettericck seemed to be on some other planet. Brutal, standing beside old Sparky, gave me a small finger tilt as we stepped up onto the platform. He holstered his sidearm and took John's wrist, escorting him toward the electric chair as gently as a boy leading his date out onto the floor for their first dance as a couple.
"Everything all right, John?" he asked in a low voice.
"Yes, boss, but..."
His eyes were moving from side to side in their sockets, and for the first time he looked and sounded scared.
"But there's a lot of folks here hate me. A lot. I can feel it. Hurts. Bores in like bee stings and hurts."
"Feel how we feel, then," he said in that same low voice. "We don't hate you. Can you feel that?"
"Yes, boss."
But his voice was trembling worse now, and his eyes had begun to leak their slow tears again.
"Kill him twice, you boys!"
Marjorie Dettericck suddenly screamed. Her ragged, strident voice was like a slap. John cringed against me and moaned.
"You go on and kill that raping baby killer twice, that'll be just fine!"
Klaus, still looking like a man dreaming awake, pulled her against his shoulder. She began to sob. I saw with dismay that Harry Terwilliger was crying, too. So far, none of the spectators had seen his tears. His back was to them, but he was crying, all right. Still, what could we do? Besides push on with it, I mean. Brutal and I turned John around. Brutal pressed on one of the big man's shoulders, and John sat. He gripped Sparky's wide oak arms, his eyes moving from side to side, his tongue darting out to wet first one corner of his mouth, then the other. Harry and I dropped to our knees. The day before, we'd had one of the shop trustees weld temporary flexible extensions to the chair's ankle clamps, because John Coffey's ankles were nigh on the size of an ordinary fellow's calves. Still, I had a nightmarish moment when I thought they were still going to come up small, and we'd have to take him back to his cell, while Sam Broderick, who was head of the shop guys in those days, was found and tinkered some more. I gave a final, extra-hard shove with the heels of my hands, and the clamp on my side closed. John's leg jerked, and he gasped. I had pinched him.
"Sorry, John," I murmured and glanced at Harry.
He had gotten his clamp fixed more easily. Either the extension on his side was a little bigger or John's right calf was a little smaller. But he was looking at the result with a doubtful expression. I guessed I could understand why. The modified clamps had a hungry look, their jaws seeming to gape like the mouths of alligators.
"It'll be all right," I said, hoping that I sounded convincing and that I was telling the truth. "Wipe your face, Harry."
He swabbed at it with his arm, wiping away tears from his cheeks and beads of sweat from his forehead. We turned. Homer Kribus, who had been talking too loudly to the man sitting next to him, the prosecutor, judging from the string tie and rusty black suit, fell silent. It was almost time. Brutal had clamped one of John's wrists, Dean the other. Over Dean's shoulder I could see the doctor, unobtrusive as ever, standing against the wall with his black bag between his feet. Nowadays, I guess they just about run such affairs, especially the ones with the IV drips. But back then, you almost had to yank them forward if you wanted them. Maybe back then they had a clearer idea of what was right for a doctor to be doing and what was a perversion of the special promise they make, the one where they swear, first of all, to do no harm. Dean nodded to Brutal. Brutal turned his head, seemed to glance at the telephone that was never going to ring for the likes of John Coffey, and called, "Roll on one," to Jack Van Hay. There was that hum, like an old fridge kicking on, and the lights burned a little brighter. Our shadows stood out a little sharper, black shapes that climbed the wall and seemed to hover around the shadow of the chair like vultures. John drew in a sharp breath. His knuckles were white.
"Does it hurt yet?"
Mrs. Dederick shrieked brokenly from against her husband's shoulder.
"I hope it does. I hope it hurts like hell."
Her husband squeezed her. One side of his nose was bleeding, I saw, a narrow trickle of red working its way down into his narrow gauge mustache. When I opened the paper the following March and saw he'd died of a stroke, I was about the least surprised man on earth. Brutal stepped into John's field of vision. He touched John's shoulder as he spoke. That was irregular, but of the witnesses, only Curtis Anderson knew it, and he did not seem to remark it. I thought he looked like a man who only wants to be done with his current job, desperately wants to be done with it. He enlisted in the Army after Pearl Harbor, but never got overseas. He died at Fort Bragg in a truck accident. John, meanwhile, relaxed beneath Brutal's fingers. I don't think he understood much, if any, of what Brutal was telling him, but he took comfort from Brutal's hand on his shoulder. Brutal, who died of a heart attack about 25 years later, he was eating a fish sandwich and watching TV wrestling when it happened, his sister said, was a good man. My friend. Maybe the best of us. He had no trouble understanding how a man could simultaneously want to go and still be terrified of the trip. "John Coffey, you have been condemned to die in the electric chair. Sentence passed by a jury of your peers and imposed by a judge of good standing in this state. God save the people of this state. Do you have anything to say before a sentence is carried out?" John wet his lips again, then spoke clearly, 6 words.
"I'm sorry for what I am."
"You ought to be!"
the mother of the 2 dead girls screamed.
"Oh, you monster! You ought to be! You damn well ought to be!"
John's eyes turned to me. I saw no resignation in them, no hope of heaven, no dawning peace. How I would love to tell you that I did. How I would love to tell myself that. What I saw was fear, misery, incompletion, and incomprehension. They were the eyes of a trapped and terrified animal. I thought of what he'd said about how Wharton had gotten Cora and Kathy Dederick off the porch without rousing the house. "He killed them with their love. That's how it is every day, all over the world." Brutal took the new mask from its brass hook on the back of the chair, but as soon as John saw it and understood what it was, his eyes widened in horror. He looked at me, and now I could see huge droplets of sweat standing out on the curve of his naked skull. As big as robin's eggs, they looked.
"Please, boss, don't put that thing over my face," he said in a moaning little whisper. "Please don't put me in the dark. Don't make me go into the dark. I was afraid of the dark."
Brutal was looking at me, eyebrows raised, frozen in place, the mask in his hands. His eyes said it was my call. He'd go either way.
I thought as fast as I could, and as well as I could, hard to do with my head pounding the way it was. The mask was tradition, not law. It was, in fact, to spare the witnesses. And suddenly I decided that they did not need to be spared. Not this once. John, after all, hadn't done a damned thing in his life to warrant being where he was. They didn't know that, but we did, and I decided I was going to grant this last request. As for Marjorie Dederich, she'd probably send me a thank you note. All right, John, I murmured. Brutal put the mask back. From behind us, Homer Kribus called out indignantly in his deep-dish cracker voice,
"Say, boy, put that damn mask on him. Think we want to watch his eyes pop?"
"Be quiet, sir," I said without turning. "This is an execution, and you're not in charge of it."
"Any more than you were in charge of catching him, you tub of guts," Harry whispered.
Harry died in 1982, close to the age of 80, an old man. Not in my league, of course, but few are. It was intestinal cancer of some kind. Brutal bent over and plucked the disc of sponge out of its bucket. He pressed a finger into it and licked the tip, but he hardly had to. I could see the ugly brown thing dripping. He tucked it into the cap, then put the cap on John's head. For the first time I saw that Brutal was pale too, pasty white, on the verge of passing out. I thought of him saying that he felt for the first time in his life that he was in danger of hell because we were fixing to kill a gift of God. I felt a sudden and strong need to retch. I controlled it, but only with an effort. Water from the sponge was dripping down the sides of John's face. Dean Stanton ran the strap, let out to its maximum length on this occasion, across John's chest and gave it to me. We had taken such pains to try and protect Dean on the night of our trip because of his kids, never knowing that he had less than 4 months to live. After John Coffey, he requested and received a transfer away from old Sparky over to C Block, and there a prisoner stabbed him in the throat with a shank and let out his life's blood on a dirty board floor. I never knew why. I don't think anyone ever knew why. Old Sparky seems such a thing of perversity when I look back on those days, such a deadly bit of folly. Fragile as blown glass we are, even under the best of conditions. To kill each other with gas and electricity and in cold blood? The folly. The horror. Brutal checked the strap, then stood back. I waited for him to speak, but he didn't. As he crossed his hands behind his back and stood at parade rest, I knew that he wouldn't, perhaps couldn't. I didn't think I could either. But then I looked at John's terrified, weeping eyes and knew I had to. Even if it damned me forever, I had to.
"Roll on to,"
I said in a dusty, cracking voice I hardly recognized as my own. The cap hummed. 8 large fingers and 2 large thumbs rose from the ends of the chair's broad oak arms and splayed tensely in 10 different directions, their tips jittering. His big knees made caged pistoning motions, but the clamps on his ankles held. Overhead, 3 of the hanging lights blew out.
Pow! Pow! Pow!
Marjorie Dederich screamed at the sound and fainted in her husband's arms. She died in Memphis 18 years later. Harry sent me the obit. It was a trolley car accident. John surged forward against the chest strap. For a moment, his eyes met mine. They were aware. I was the last thing he saw as we tilted him off the edge of the world. Then he fell against the seat back, the cap coming askew on his head, a little smoke, a sort of charry mist drifting out from beneath it. But on the whole, you know, it was quick. I doubt if it was painless, the way the chair's supporters always claim. It's not an idea even the most rabid of them ever seems to want to investigate personally. But it was quick. The hands were limp again. the formerly bluish-white moons at the base of the fingernails now a deep eggplant hue, a tendril of smoke rising off cheeks still wet with salt water from the sponge, and his tears. John Coffey's last tears. Chapter 11. I was all right until I got home. It was dawn by then, and birds singing. I parked my flivver, I got out, I walked up the back steps, and then the second greatest grief I have ever known washed over me. It was thinking of how he'd been afraid of the dark that did it. I remembered the first time we'd met, how he'd asked if we left a light on at night, and my legs gave out on me. I sat on my steps and hung my head over my knees and cried. It didn't feel like that weeping was just for John either, but for all of us. Janice came out and sat down beside me. She put an arm over my shoulders. "You didn't hurt him any more than you could help, did you?" I shook my head, "No." "And he wanted to go." I nodded. "Come in the house," she said, helping me up. It made me think of the way John had helped me up after we'd prayed together. "Come in and have coffee." I did. The first morning passed, and the first afternoon, then the first shift back at work. Time takes it all, whether you want it to or not. Time takes it all. Time bears it away. And in the end, there is only darkness. Sometimes we find others in that darkness, and sometimes we lose them there again. That's all I know, except that this happened in 1932, when the state penitentiary was still at Cold Mountain. And the electric chair, of course.